you seated, please. First case on our calendar is 98-1891, State of Ohio versus Elwood Hubert Jones. Ms. Agar.
Thank you.
I don't think your microphone is on. I want to make sure that we're recording.
Particularly the question of the doctor-patient privilege, because again, we're before the court on an issue that was not raised at the trial level by counsel, and therefore we're dealing with a record that probably is not as complete as it could be, and some issues that the court really doesn't have as much information on as would have been presented if this matter had been litigated at the trial level by way of a motion and perhaps an evidentiary hearing to establish what's going on. Nevertheless, I think that the First District Court of Appeals was a little cavalier in dismissing the record as containing no evidence of what counsel or defendant's intentions were in this regard, because I think the record does clearly establish that this was not a technical decision on the part of defense counsel, and that defendant nor defense counsel wanted this evidence to come in.
Why do you say that?
Because Dr. McDonough's testimony, although it was not contested on the ground patient doctor privilege, was hotly contested on other grounds. Defense counsel raised an objection first to his qualification as an expert witness in order to present testimony at all, and second, during the course of his testimony, when it became clear that he was not the person who had taken some of the notes that were being testified to and had not performed some of the procedures that he was testifying to, they objected on those grounds, that he was offering an opinion based on an examination that he did not conduct or surgery that he did not perform, and that the materials from which he was testifying were never introduced into evidence. So there was an attempt to keep this material out of the record.
But your strongest argument appears to be the physician-patient privilege.
Certainly, I would say that is the first and most obvious problem with the presentation of documents on this testimony. And there simply is no logical or rational reason in the record why defense counsel would have considered this issue and simply rejected out of hand.
Well, isn't it quite clear under the statute that when a doctor encounters an injury that's caused by deadly weapon, but also by violence, that he has a duty to report that, and that the physician-patient privilege does not apply in those instances?
There is a statute that provides that a doctor has a duty to report certain types of injury under certain circumstances, and if that is what had occurred here, that might be an issue.
Well, why isn't that what occurred here? This was a expert in the area of these types of injuries.
The problem was is that Dr. McDonough did not report this injury.
Sorry?
And in fact, apparently never even considered it as a serious injury as a result of a violent offense until he was approached by the police some 7 to 10 days after the defendant had already been discharged from his care. So this is not a circumstance where the defendant comes in, the doctor looks, says, this is an injury that's clearly the result of a criminal act. And
I thought the doctor had said to the defendant, who did you hit or something like that, initially when he came in.
The doctor had some conversation with him about how the injury took place and said that, you know, this looks like it was a fight, and the defendant said, no, it was an injury through work. The doctor apparently accepted that explanation at the time because he recommended that the workers' compensation claim be granted. It was granted routinely. It was not contested by either the employer or the workers' comp representative. And in fact, the workers' compensation claim was paid. So there was no reporting of this as a criminal act by the doctor. This is not a circumstance restriction.
Are you saying that that's a, that that has to be done first before the patient, physician-patient privilege would apply, that the doctor actually has to report it?
I'm saying that before the doctor-patient privilege, which is also statutory, and that's within the statute, is waived by the clinical statute.
That's right. It's waived. It doesn't exist.
It's waived if the doctor reports it as a bodily injury. And that's what the Angel case says, is that once the doctor has reported and brought the police in as a result of his report, that then the whole purpose of privacy has been eliminated because it's already been made public. And from that point, there's no problem with having the doctor test it.
Wouldn't it be more reasonable, though, when a doctor encounters such an injury, that the physician-patient privilege does not apply under any circumstances, whether the doctor reports it or doesn't report it?
Again, without waiving the privilege, without breaching the privilege, how do we get to that point in this case? Dr. McDonough did not make that determination. He did not report this to the police as a violation.
I'm saying that a doctor does not have to report it in order for the privilege to be waived.
But
it comes to the attention that, let's say this is a gunshot wound. A doctor treats a gunshot wound, doesn't report it. Later it comes to the attention of the police. There shouldn't be any physician patient privilege in that instance.
Well, the gunshot wound is dealt with in a slightly separate portion of the statute because there the fact that the injury is a result of criminal agency is obvious. Gunshot wound, a burn that is the result of an arson event. There are certain types of specific injuries that the statute deals with separately. Then there's kind of a catch-all provision. That if it is a serious physical injury, it's caused by a violent assault. That's a judgment call on the part of the physician. The police can't make that judgment call and can't make that call without first breaching the doctor patient privilege and obtaining the information from the physician. So what we have here is a catch-22, that it's okay for the police to come in, breach the doctor patient privilege, obtain confidential information, then based on the confidential information that they've obtained, go back to the statute and say, now that we have the confidential information, we can justify it.
But my point is anything that falls under that statute, the physician-patient privilege does not exist.
But the problem is you cannot tell if it falls under the statute unless the doctor makes that judgment call. It's the doctor's judgment call as to whether this falls under the statute or not.
But in this case, didn't the doctor believe personally that it was a close fist injury, but he wasn't going to challenge the worker, he wasn't going to take it up as an issue, but he truly believed it was a close fist injury because of the type of injury, and he's an expert in that type of injury.
Well, there's a problem with that. That is what the doctor's testimony was in trial, but this is after the doctor has been approached by the police officers and basically told that that's what happened here and presented with the scenario.
Well, the doctor could still have said, now it could be close fist, it could be this, it could be that, it could be a lot of different things. But the physical evidence that I saw was post-fist. Now you are giving me some evidence that what I believe is true is in fact true. I mean, it's just simply verification.
Well, the problem with that scenario is that if the doctor truly believed at the time that he did the examination that this was a post-fist injury, then he committed a criminal offense by failing to report.
That may well be, but that shouldn't affect the criminal.
Again, it's a matter of which if defense counsel had raised this issue by way of a motion, and that your hearing could have been held and could have gotten to the bottom of the doctor's motivation and the reason why he spoke to the police without ever raising the privilege himself under those circumstances. Why he did not initially report the injury, why he reported it to workers' comp as an employment-related injury and allowed the workers' comp claim to be processed without dispute. There certainly is substantial conflict in the record as to whether Dr. McDonough would have or could have considered this to be a reportable injury until he was approached personally by the police. He certainly did not initiate that report himself. And again, it's failure of defense counsel to file a motion to raise this issue, to give the court a chance to hold an evidentiary hearing on the issue, that we don't have the record before us to make that determination. But it's clearly an issue that should have been raised. counsel was negligent for not raising. Certainly, when you have the client's personal position, taking his witness stand and testifying against him in a proceeding, doctor-patient privilege has to be the first thing that comes to mind.
Was that his personal position? I thought he went to him for the workers' comp claim.
Well, he went to him personally for treatment for this specific injury. The doctor examined him, treated him, performed surgery on his hand, provided treatment after surgery. Yes, he was a personal physician. He was not someone he was referred to by the workers' comp board for an examination. He was not someone he was referred to by his employer for an examination. He went there for treatment initially. The workers' comp claim was not filed until after he realized the treatment was going to entail some very expensive surgery. He went to this doctor because his hand was infected. He was sore and he needed help. So yes, I think clearly Dr. McDonald was a personal physician in this situation. Under that scenario, the issue of doctor-patient privilege was raised and explored by defense counsel. And there simply is no legal or tactical reason on the face of the record anywhere that would justify defense counsel's failure to raise that issue fully litigated and to at least give the defendant an opportunity to bar this extremely damaging testimony. It simply wasn't done. It's only fair, I guess, under the circumstances, if I'm going to take my shots at the prosecutor now, since I already had my shot at defense counsel. And it's certainly nothing new that back before the court with some of these same problems that we see cropping up in capital cases time and time again. Despite many pronouncements by this court on the issue of arguing the facts and circumstances of the case, the hideousness of the killing, the death itself is an aggravating circumstance, we've got the same issue raised again in this case, where the prosecutor looks at the jury and says, look at this woman's death. This, her life was not more important to the defendant than this piece of jewelry. When you go in and do your weighing of the aggravated circumstances, I hope you'll give her life more weight than he gave. There's no other way to interpret that comment than to tell the jury that the aggravating circumstance, what they're to weigh against the defense mitigation in this case, is the death.
The point is made on the other side, however, that there was no mitigation presented by the defense, and therefore there was nothing to weigh, therefore nothing prejudicial.
Well, that's another problem that's raised by basically a change in the law in this case. There was mitigation presented, the mitigation factor that was presented by defense counsel was residual doubt.
And that was all.
Right. Now, I'm aware of the fact that since the time of that trial, this court has rejected residual doubt as a mitigating circumstance. That was not the state of the law at the time that this trial was conducted. If it was, I'm sure defense counsel might have reconsidered and possibly defendant would have reconsidered their decision to rely on that factor or to rely present no other evidence in mitigation.
But what we're talking about, as I understand it, is the trinket or the pendant that the prosecutor was talking about that he had taken and therefore he, the defendant, had taken and therefore that's what, quote, tripped him up. What was there? I want to concede to you under Wogenstahl, I think that's a violation. But it's a and particularly here where the defense objected and they didn't in Wogenstahl. How does that, though, equate to prejudicial or reversible error when there was no real weighing going on except the issue of residual doubt, which had nothing to do with that aggravating circumstance?
Well, residual doubt at that point in time, I think, was clearly an issue. It was by law at that point in time an issue, and the jury was entitled to weigh it. We don't know what kind of weight the jury gave to it, whether it considered it at all, or what kind of balancing job the jury did back in chambers. But we do know that they were instructed not only that Rhoda Nathan's death was an aggravating circumstance to be weighed against that, whatever weight they gave it. But they were also told basically that defense counsel, by failing to raise any other issues in mitigation or present any evidence, had forfeited.
Are you now...
Are
you now arguing the Wogenstahl issue separately from the other alleged prosecutorial misconduct, or are you making it a conglomeration?
Well, I don't think that any of them can be looked at separately in his individual incidents.
Except the Wogenstahl issue is really a separate issue, isn't it, altogether? I mean,
It's separate from...
It's a separate propositional law. It's a separate fact. It's a separate... error, if it's error.
It's separate, perhaps, from the trial phase error in that it would apply only, and it didn't occur until after the jury verdict had been returned, so it would apply only to the results of the sentencing phase of the trial.
But you want to
so
put the...
It's separate, not from all of the comments, but at least from the comments that were made solely with relation to the question of guilt or innocence.
But you want to put the Wogenstahl error in with the... comments denigrating the doctor, the physician that testified on behalf of the defendant, the questioning of the motives of defense counsel.
I guess
I'm classing them differently in my mind. The one body of all of these improper comments, as opposed to a very specific legal error, which is using something that is not an aggravating circumstance in weighing.
The problem is that when you get this type of comment going on continuously during the trial, that there's carryover. The jury doesn't turn off in their mind everything that happened at the initial phase of the trial. They don't forget that basically they've been told that defense counsel is dishonest, that they're not above hiring witnesses to testify the way they want them to testify, even though witnesses haven't seen the evidence yet. They don't forget that they've been told that the defense attorney essentially is a hired gun and that they should ignore what they're saying, that they don't really believe in the client. Those thoughts don't leave the jury's mind when they consider the issue of sentencing either. And there is an interplay between these types of errors. So it's really hard to isolate them if it's something that occurred in front of the jury, that occurred in the jury's presence.
How do you pronounce it?
If it's a purely legal error that occurred outside the jury's presence, then maybe you don't have the same kind of carryover effect.
How do you pronounce that doctor's name? Is it Slomkin?
Slomkin.
What was that all about? That I read the record part of that, and it just confuses me what the prosecutor was saying with regard to Dr. Slomkin and the interviewing of him by defense counsel or not interviewing him. What was that about?
The problem with that was a procedural thing, that Dr. Slomkin was not available to have his deposition taken until after the trial had actually started. Opening statements were made on the 15th. The actual deposition of Dr. Slomkin was not done until the 16th. And at that point in time was the first time that certain medical records were physically handed to him to look at, to go through prior to the deposition. Now, it's clear, I think, from the record that defense counsel had discussed with the doctor the state of these records, what the records showed, that the issue had been discussed with him, and that he had already told them in advance what he thought his opinion was going to be based on what they had given him.
What point was the prosecutor making?
The prosecutor was saying that because defense counsel got up in opening statements and said, we believe our expert is going to testify to this, this, and this, and that Dr. Slomkin in his deposition said, admitted that he hadn't looked at these specific records until the morning of the deposition, that therefore the only way that defense counsel could have known what he was going to say before he looked at the records was because he was going to say whatever they told him.
Let's assume that was true. What's wrong with that? I mean, you do that with experts all the time.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but that's not the impression the jury's given. The impression the jury's given is he said what they told him to say, and if he didn't pay any attention to the records, he didn't have to look at the records that he was going to say he would not look at them.
I see.
Which basically tells the jury this guy's a hired gun, the defense counsel paid for him, he's going to say whatever they want him to say, so you could ignore his opinion.
Don't ever have to explain that to the jury. They understand that early on.
Well, sure, yeah, they understand it real well. I mean, when you look at the jury and say, remember, this guy was a hired defense expert, and you consider that that the attitude that jurors get from newspaper accounts of some of these high publicity trials and hired experts telling you to say basically whatever either side wants them to say, I mean, that's an impression that the general public has.
Is it error when the defense counsel says about the prosecution's witnesses, these are people paid for, procured and paid for by the state, and they're here testifying, being paid by the state? Is that error?
Well, the problem is...
If it is here, it is there, and we never can do anything about that.
But the problem is that the state has some aura of legitimacy in the juror's eyes. The defense counsel, unfortunately, isn't cloaked with that aura. We've got an uphill battle to start with, considering the way that the defense counsel in general is portrayed in the press. And when the prosecution adds to that by suggesting, in this case, that an expert witness that was paid for by the state, not by defense counsel, you understand, this was a court-appointed expert.
Mm-hmm.
Defense counsel didn't pay for this expert out of his pocket, neither did defendant. And furthermore, the prosecution who tried this case knew that because they opposed his appointment. And it required a hearing before the judge to get him appointed and paid. So they deliberately misled the jury that this was some expert that the defense counsel had paid for out of his own pocket or the defendant had paid for, and that he was therefore going to say whatever they wanted him to say. And like I said, we have an uphill battle to start with when the prosecution chimes in and helps the juries along with these kind of false impressions. There's no telling how much of that slops over onto the defendant. This is not an open and shut case. There was no confession. There was only circumstantial evidence.
Is that where the residual doubt comes from?
Yes. I think, given the state of the law at the time of the trial, the residual doubt was a legitimate mitigating circumstance in this case.
But the circumstantial evidence was quite strong. They found in his truck in a toolbox, a very unusual pendant, a pass key that opened room 237, that he was right across the hall from working in a banquet room, right across the hall from the room at the time of it. None of his co-workers could vouch for him when he said he was working the breakfast area. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence in addition to the doctor's testimony.
There was a fair amount of circumstantial evidence in addition to the doctor's testimony, all of which defense had at least some counter and some explanation for, a lot of which applied to many of the employees of the hotel on that day. Certainly matters like the passkey, it was made pretty clear in the testimony that passkeys were widely distributed amongst the staff.
But everybody didn't have them in their toolboxes.
That many people had them available. That it was not unknown for them to go home with the employees.
How did they attempt to get around very damaging and very, very unbelievable evidence of the pendant in his trunk of his car? How did defense counsel explain that away?
There was some testimony that the car and the tools had been borrowed by another employee of the hotel, that they were out of his possession for a substantial period of time, and that he had not had access to or opened the toolbox since that point in time.
And that person had access to putting the toolbox back in the defendant's car, had his keys and so forth.
That he had actually borrowed the car as well as the toolbox.
The car.
Did he testify to that effect?
At this point in time, I don't recall who it was that testified or how that evidence was presented, but there was evidence that.
I think it was just the defendant's testimony.
It might have been his statement to the police officers at the time.
Yeah, I don't recall that they never had a person testify to that, did they? They didn't ever have any more reliable testimony than the defendant's word for it, correct?
I believe that it was the defendant's statement that it was his explanation for it.
There was nothing ever...
You can hardly expect the person in question to come in and put himself in jeopardy of being considered a suspect.
But other than the word of the defendant, is that what's happened?
Right.
That was it.
But again, and by the way, the defendant's statement was introduced by the state, not by defense counsel. They put the statement on the stand. They put it before the jury.
And moreover, there was testimony that when he came to work, he didn't have an injury on his hand, and then later he was observed by his co-employees with the injury.
That's correct. I don't think there was any dispute in anybody's statements that the injury occurred that day. The dispute was how it occurred. And there were witnesses who indicated that he had explained how it occurred on the dumpster, that he had struck his hand while he was taking the garbage out, that he emptied the dumpster. An environment obviously where one can pick up some strange bacteria. So at least there was an explanation in that regard also. There's also some suggestions that the injury could have been contaminated with the Eikenella bacteria because a normal reaction when one gets a hand injury is to put the hand in the mouth.
Must defense counsel put on mitigating evidence if it's the wish of the defendant not to?
The state of the law at this point in time seems to say no. The problem with this case is wasn't the defendant's wish not to put on any mitigation. His wish was to put on only residual doubt in mitigation. And at that point in time, the state of the law allowed that as a mitigating circumstance.
Well, but he eliminated all other except.
That's right. And defense counsel got caught in a rather difficult dilemma. You're always in a difficult situation when your defendant wishes to do something or not to do something that you believe is not in his best interest.
Well, what do you do in that case? Whose case is it?
Well, it's the defendant's call, I believe, so long as the defendant is competent to make that call. And in some cases, I think it might be necessary to obtain an expert opinion, too.
Was there evidence that this man was not competent?
At this point, in this record, I do not believe there's any evidence to support finding he's incompetent.
So, you feel if a defendant is confident that the defense counsel must follow the dictates of the defendant?
I believe that's true. It's in the state of the law as it presently stands. Now, again, there was not a lot of guidance for defense counsel in this area at the time.
Can you then raise that as a assignment of error?
Well, my opinion is not controlling either. I believe that the state of the law as it exists now, as we argue it, that my reading of the law is that it's not. I still believe that it is a legitimate area for the courts to look at and possibly to reconsider the state of the law as it is now, because I do believe that it puts defense counsel in an extremely difficult position.
What do you say the state of the law is on that point presently?
I think that the state of the law at that point presently is that if your client is competent, you render that decision, and that he is adamantly opposed to the presentation of mitigation, the defense counsel at least is not required to. But I think there may still be a question as to whether defense counsel may do so, but I don't believe they're required to.
Does defense counsel, to protect himself, then have to put in the record what he feels is available to the defendant as far as mitigation is concerned, and that because of the wishes of his client, that he wants to make it clear for the court that he is knowledgeable about these mitigating factors, but he is not going to be able to use them because his client refuses to let him? Does he have to do that?
Well, I don't believe he has to do that because his obligation to his client, not
should he?
Himself and covering his own career.
Well,
I think it's probably a very wise thing to do.
Well, you know you're going to get a ineffective senses of counsel error thrown at you if you have 15 things that you feel can help your client, but he refuses to let you do that. How he is to protect himself against that allegation?
I think you certainly need to make a record as to the defendant's wishes in the matter. I think it's also very wise to make a record simply for the sake of post-conviction proceedings that you have fully investigated the availability of mitigation. I see my time is just about up here, unless there's any other questions.
I have one question. I'm sorry to take the extra time you have. Without Dr. McDonough's testimony, and the whole ineffective assistance of counsel issue that that raises, would we only, we would nevertheless have testimony about the injury, I mean, we would know he had an injury, defendant had an injury to his hand.
Yes.
And would we have known from the medical records that the injury included the infection that typically comes from contact with saliva without Dr. McDonough?
That I don't believe we would know. In fact, Dr. McDonough could not, since it was not his precise area of expertise, he actually called in a consulting physician in that field to identify the bacteria.
Well, okay. So we wouldn't know that at all. Though there sounds like there was testimony, that would have been in rebuttal to say, gee, the garbage or the dumpster had the same sort of bacteria.
Right. That would
it would never would have been. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eggar. Mr. Springer.
Thank you, please, for Ms. Eggar. Again, I guess in a lot of these cases, most of the argument in this case is centered on the performance of counsel for the defense and against the prosecution. A lot was said about physician patient privilege. In my brief to the Court of Appeals and to this court, I let off with the argument that the doctor done would have been required to report this injury because it was indicative of violence or indicative of criminal behavior. And under the statute 2921-22B, he would have been, under the law, required to report it. Therefore, the physician-patient privilege would not have attached. I also made the argument that since Mr. Jones engaged in a pattern of deception with his physician and indicated that he injured his hand in a way that was possible to happen in medical terms, that there was no relationship with the physician-patient privilege. Now, the Court of Appeals sort of agreed with that. We had a concurring opinion that adopted that argument. The majority adopted the argument that perhaps Mr. Jones himself did not want to hide anything, and therefore he didn't want to invoke the physician-patient privilege. And I didn't think of that argument. I didn't raise it to the Court of Appeals that did that sui sponte, but in thinking about it, it's very compelling. And I was noticing in defense counsel's closing argument, specifically in 1774, they made a pretty big deal, a pretty forceful argument about how Jones did not want to hide this injury. And this is defense counsel talking. They said, did he ever make an effort to hide this? Question mark. Did he ever, and they're referring to his hand injury, did he ever say, no, 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 I didn't cut my hand, no, no, no? And they made that argument to the jury that he didn't have anything to hide.
But that, so. Counsel, I don't know about that argument, because the fact was they were making final argument in a case where this doctor had testified.
That's true.
Defense counsel makes the point that though counsel failed to raise the physician-patient privilege, counsel raised hearsay and other defenses to try to keep that testimony out. Once it's in, you know, now we can't go to the final argument and say, gee, that's your strategy.
True, but I'm pointing out that I didn't think of making.
Right. Let's say that neither. If we could for a moment say that neither of those arguments that you started off, that as you suggest started out in your brief or that the Court of Appeals latched onto, let's say neither of those is all that persuasive given that the statute speaks of gunshot and stab and that the trial strategy argument maybe doesn't have a lot of weight. Where would you be then on the ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to Dr. McDonough and whether or not the absence of that testimony would have allowed there to be reasonable doubt?
Judge, if I understand the question correctly, this reporting statute does talk about if an offense is as a result of an offense of violence, in addition to staff when you've been burned, when you've been anything else. It was recently amended to include an offense of violence.
Yeah.
But if I think I understand your question correctly, it's the same one we had defense counsel. I would be arguing that there was no prejudice because of the other evidence that came in against Jones, including, I think the police officers testified that they knew that the defendant had an injury to his hand because the blows on the victim's body were forceful.
Right.
I don't see where the physician-patient privilege would bar any of that evidence from coming
in. Right. It would have been a hand, we would have known there'd be a hand injury.
Right, we would have known there was a hand injury. We would have had somewhat of a pattern of deception that Jones engaged in with his fellow employees. That evidence would have come in. We had the pendant. We had the fact that it's kind of hard, at least for me when I wrote the brief, to visualize because some of these photographs that were admitted into trial showed that this was an atrium-type structure in Embassy Suites Hotel. And so the victims, the two victims here were, the one victim, there's three, two of them arrived earlier, and the victim herself arrived a little bit later than her two companions. So Jones was present when Rhoda's friends, the victim's friends arrived, and he was able to observe them. So we were able to show that he knew that there were only two people, or he believed that there were only two people in room 237. And then he saw those two people the next morning eating breakfast, because it was an atrium-type structure down in the Comm breakfast room. So that gave him the opportunity then to go into room 237, hoping that no one was there. So we were able to sort of narrow down a suspect pool because of that. And he was assigned to that area, and he engaged in a pattern of deception, knowing he was assigned to that area, and telling fellow employees he was not assigned to that area. So that's other evidence that we would have had in addition to the pendant. And also the pendant is somewhat interesting. I don't know if this is kind of a subtle point to catch, but the pendant is not all that. It's unique. It was made of her mother's father's jewelry. But when you look at it, it's something that you could get out of, I don't want to say demeanor, but like costume jewelry. And so one thing that happened during Jones' statements is he initiated, once he exercised his right to silence, he initiated conversation with the police and inquired the nature of the charges, and he asked about it. And then he claimed that they showed a picture of the pendant that was found, and Jones claimed, I never saw that pendant before in my life. Well, then for that to be in the toolbox in the trunk of his car also links into the crime. I think that was a very important piece of evidence, both the statement and the finding of the pendant. So we have that as evidence against him. We also have Stokes' testimony. We also have Oliver's testimony. Again, they match up. They don't say that the objects that were in Jones' possession, they couldn't say for certainty whether those caused the injuries or the wound patterns on her body. But they could say that her wound patterns were very similar to the outlines of a walkie-talkie radio and into the leather case that was seized from Jones.
Did the defense put forth any other employees as legitimate suspects? In other words, someone else maybe had a hand injury, or because that was the point, somebody borrowed the car, somebody else was available to, was there any effort? It was just really a defense of reasonable doubt, I take it, not that there was pointing to another suspect.
Actually, Judge was pointing to another suspect. Okay. The closing argument, when defense counsel started off, they said, this is a case about who's done it. I'm not going to lay out all the statutory elements of the offense for you because it's really who has done it. And their closing argument centered on two people. Now, they presented the testimony of Greg Henry. That was the last witness of the defense call. And they asked him some questions, and at first, you know, as you're going through the record, they seem innocuous. And so you get the closing argument, they tried to tie it in, and they said, what about him? Why didn't they check him out? And they certainly implied that they were other suspects. And their whole defense was that the police, they started off with a mistake because they didn't seize the victim's purse in the hotel room. Because when they initially were called to the scene, they thought the victim had fallen or had a heart attack. So once the victim's purse was seized and money was missing, then they secured the area. And then one of the police officers noticed the trauma to the victim's body. And at that point, they thought they were dealing with a homicide. So anyway, the defense still focused on that this was shoddy police work. That was to show reasonable doubt. And in that vein, they elicited, you know, the testimony of this Bill McCall, which we were able to call as a rebuttal witness, because they implied that he perhaps was one of the murderers, because they didn't check him out enough, because he was hired and quickly left the Embassy Suites Hotel shortly after the murder. It's really, you know, that was a coincidence, but they looked into that, and we were able to present his testimony to neutralize their theory that perhaps he was involved in the murder. But Greg Henry, they focused a lot about him, how, why didn't they check him out, and tried to lay a foundation and present to the jury that he had an opportunity to commit this offense. But the focus was all on Jones, improperly on Jones, and I think that...
Any chance that the, was it Greg, that the other gentleman, any chance he was the gentleman who borrowed the car?
Greg Henry?
Greg Henry?
No, not at all. Nothing linked to the car. Again, I think some of these circumstantial evidence cases, when you look at each piece of evidence, it may seem obvious, but as it starts to build, it builds, sometimes it's a stronger case than direct testimony, which attacks the credibility of the eyewitness.
I'd like to get back to the doctor's testimony. You're not abandoning the fact that this was a injury caused by violence, that the physician-patient privilege was waived.
I think it's fairly waived. I know you wrote about it in the middle, and I think that, you know, why here, too.
Well, on that issue, as Justice Resnick points out, didn't this arise, the examination arise out of a workers' compensation claim?
Right, did he check himself?
No, just did it. Did it arise out of a workers' compensation claim? Didn't he go for treatment when he was applying for workers' compensation?
Yes.
And doesn't the statute in privilege specifically exempt from the physician-patient privilege anything that arises under workers' compensation?
Yeah.
Those are all public records.
Right. That's true, too. So his injury, that evidence could come in through there.
Who tried this case in your office?
Mr. Pietmeyer and Mr. Teeger. But, again, I really thought that the reporting statute was where the Court of Appeals would go on this. They did it different than I would, because it does say any serious physical harm to a person that he knows has reasonable cause to believe resulted in offensive violence. Now, again, with the Dr. McDonough, at first he looked and diagnosed his tennis hand injury when he walked into Bethesda Hospital. But then when he sent the cultures to the lab, after he performed surgery, he sent cultures to the lab. And when he received those cultures back, it came back with this mixed flora or Iconella corrodens. And at that point, he certainly was alerted that this could possibly be an offense of violence. Because the last time he had seen something like that was in fight by the clenched fist injury. And at that point, I think he knew that an offense of violence could be the cause. And I think that's another reason why the reporting statute really should be invoked here and allows the physician-patient privilege to be waived, because he would have been faced with a dilemma. And so whether or not there's that independent tort for unauthorized, unprivileged communication. But he's faced with a dilemma of, either repercussions of the reporting statute or he could face a tort. So, I think that's the problem physicians face. I think Bill answered that question. And again, I think that's where the assignment of error is. At least that's the strength of our argument, not to mean the other arguments we made or the Court of Appeals made, but I think that's the strength of it. If I go into prosecutorial misconduct, I had the fears chase. I know it's always seems to be an issue. In this case, we have 43 witnesses. It's a complicated case. I wish we all were perfect. I did admit the one thing, that Doyle violation, that was wrong. But I wanted to talk about the Wogenstahl issue, if I can, because that is occurred at page 1931 of the record again. I guess we're looking on some guidance. Maybe I don't quite understand it. When you have a aggravating circumstance, and the aggravating circumstance here was that this was a killing in the course of an aggravated robbery in the course of an aggravated murder. It seems like Mr. Pietmeyer here, when he's referring to the statements that were at issue, he says that thankfully it was a greed that tripped him up, and so on. He seems to be talking about the robbery, that, the defendant here had a desire for the victim to profit. And it's really hard, I think, for prosecutors and for anyone really to try to ask for the death penalty and leave out all the facts of the case. And I really think that's what he's doing here.
Now, wait a minute. Their obligation is to follow the statute.
Oh, exactly.
Okay. Now, let's just take it step by step, because there's a severe difference between your office, I think, and this court on what that statute says. And you're here again today arguing, in effect, that the nature and circumstances surrounding the crime can be argued as an aggravating circumstance in the weighing. That's your position, isn't it?
Yeah, I...
Okay. If that's your position, the statute doesn't say that, does it? Doesn't the statute say the specific aggravating circumstance? Now, let me give you a clear example, because I've been thinking a lot about this, because I've been reading newspaper articles and other stuff that's been going on. A man is in the process of raping a woman, murders her. In the course of that, he, and we've had one of these, batters her with a baseball bat or something, crushes her skull. Now, when you get to Wayne, is it proper for the prosecutor to say, yes, the aggravating circumstance here is the rape, which is what the statute specifies, and remember, of course, that during the course of this rape, he wasn't satisfied with that. He had to hit her with a ball bat and bash her skull, too. That's the nature and circumstances surrounding the crime, isn't it?
That is.
And is that arguable?
Well...
You wouldn't even go that far, would you?
No, but there's also a killing. It's not just a rape. We don't seek the death penalty for rape offenses.
She's dead. She's dead. She's dead in the course of a rape. And the aggravating circumstance is the rape. We agree that that's specified in the statute, don't we?
Yes.
All right. Now, the circumstance, nature and circumstances of the crime, and it's mentioned twice in the statute in different contexts, but the nature and circumstances are all of these things surrounding it. For instance, the one we had that I wrote not long ago, Rayshon Johnson, in your county, where the lady was battered with a small baseball bat up in her bathroom. Okay. What was the specification? Aggravated burglary and aggravated robbery, right? Okay, because he took her money or credit cards or something after he had killed her. Now, is it proper for you to go ahead and argue not only what the statute says is the aggravating circumstance, but all that evidence that I had a look at and saw with the blood spatter all over the walls and the coagulation so that the husband couldn't turn her over? Those are nature and circumstances. Do you put those in the weighing process? Your office consistently does that.
I know the statute clearly.
Thank you. Thank you. The statute prohibits, as you said.
Right.
Okay. I just want to be sure that that's in that microphone.
29.903D1. Right. But, you know, when discussing this, I mean, sometimes it can be much more egregious than other times. You know, if you go on and talk about the suffering of the victim and death and continue on and on, I think that's one thing where there's a clear attempt to violate the statute. But sometimes I think it is difficult to mix some of the facts when you're asking for the death penalty. And perhaps some of the words would certainly be better or better left unsaid. But I will point out that immediately afterwards, the prosecutor did say, refer the jury back to the proper weighing process. And also, you know, in some of this, there was some examples, too, that mitigate some of the damage we did that the prosecutor emphasized in the jury. And I think it's on 17. It might be 17 before the record. Somewhere early on in the prosecutor's closing argument, it was 17. I forget, but it was early on. They emphasized that, you know, what we say is not evidence. Reminded the jury, which I think is a good thing for counsel to say, in addition to what the court says in their jury instructions. And the jury instructions here.
Let me stop. How do you follow up on Justice Douglas's observations? How do we stop the prosecutors from engaging in conduct that we have told them time and time again to stop engaging in? And you just admitted that statute says one thing, you do something different. We say, don't do it, but we don't reverse. Nothing happens, and so you continue to do it. How do we stop you from doing it?
Just some of that, I think, was aggravating and mitigating circumstances. I don't know if it's really, really clear. And sometimes there are more egregious circumstances than others. I think you'll see in future cases that every effort, every attempt has been made to try to ameliorate that problem. We've got, you know, the opinions are out there. We've discussed it with all the death penalty people in our office. We've told them not to do it, you know, again and again. You know, this case is several years old, it precedes fear in some of the other cases.
So we would expect to see transcripts, records without these kinds. I mean, we recognize there are some gray areas, but there are some areas that are black and white.
Right.
And we see the black and white cases coming from your office, frankly.
I understand, yeah.
So you're saying that we can expect in cases since fears or whatever, that the records will be cleaner on this issue?
Sure, Joe, I just filed one today on the office, and there wasn't an objection in the closing argument raised by the defense counsel. All was a very clean case. So if that's any indication of what's to come, actually the closing argument in that case occurred on the day that this court issued a fear decision, which we immediately brought down to the prosecutor. So, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Springman. Ms. Agar, you saved about a minute of your time.
Very briefly, I would like to point out to the court that that's not the only area of the problem. Maybe the appellate division of the prosecutor's office also have talked to their prior case about the Doyle case. If you look at this record, the time the trial prosecutor argued for 57 pages of transcripts with the trial judge that it was appropriate to put before the jury the defendant's request for counsel and his exercising his right to silence in violation. Which the appellate division clearly admits was supposed to be appropriate. That's not the only problem we have. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.